From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Paul Gauguin, the French artist of the late 19th century, routinely had sexual relationships with children and painted nude portraits of his victims. The New York Times reports that museum curators, other artists, and social activists have, over the last several years, asked the Woody Allen question about Gauguin. Can you abhor the person and appreciate the art? Prince Andrew announced earlier this week he's stepping away from his royal duties after an interview with the BBC revealed he considered pedophile Jeffrey Epstein's behavior, quote, unbecoming. And he failed to express sympathy for the child victims of Epstein. Michael Kelly worked in New Hanover County Public Schools for more than two decades and pled guilty earlier this year to 59 charges related to child sexual abuse. Nicholas LaVon Oates died in early November while awaiting trial for molesting a student at Myrtle Grove Middle School. WECT and Port City Daily reported on the fact that Oates was repeatedly arrested for violent assaults before the Myrtle Grove incident. Starting December 1st, any person in North Carolina over 18 who could reasonably know about a case of child sexual abuse and fail to report it could be guilty of a crime. Some cases barred by a statute of limitations may proceed under this new law. The law also bans online conduct by high-risk sex offenders that endangers children. And this law unanimously passed both chambers. Governor Roy Cooper signed it in early November. The law is designed to close loopholes in existing sexual assault laws and strengthen penalties against child abusers, but some say it's still too easy for child abusers to perpetrate their crimes, even when they're not Jeffrey Epstein, Prince Andrew, or Paul Gauguin. Today, we're going to explore the role culture plays in child sexual abuse, why it's hard to prosecute a case, and the role you play in protecting children, whether you have your own or not. We'll also explore why talking about this is so hard, even and perhaps especially for adults. Joining me now from the New Hanover and Pender County District Attorney's Office, First Assistant District Attorney Lillian Salsinas-Bright. Lillian Salsinas-Bright, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Michelle Zappel is co-owner of Carolina Gymnastics Academy in Wilmington, which is an underwriter of WHQR. Michelle Zappel, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here today.
And Amy Feith is a victim services provider and is also executive director at the Carousel Center, a nonprofit that provides critical services to victims of child abuse in southeastern North Carolina. Amy Feith, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And now I want to offer a warning to our listeners. Our conversation today is probably going to be difficult. It's likely going to be upsetting. We're not going to sidestep any of the uncomfortable bits today. So this is not a conversation for kids, for young listeners, or for people who are still dealing with trauma from abuse. I want to paint the picture of what a child sexual abuser looks like. Because when I think of someone who perpetrates this kind of thing, I think of a white guy who's middle-aged, who has kind of greasy hair and dirty glasses and looks creepy. Amy Feith, how close am I?
I would say that my gut reaction was good luck trying to paint the picture of what that child sexual predator looks like, because they look like all of us. Anyone sitting in this room, anyone sitting in your school classroom, in your parish, in your neighborhood association.
They could be a man or a woman.
Could be a man or a woman. Any socioeconomic background is what our history tells us, what our experience tells us. Any racial ethnic background, any religious or affiliation background or non-affiliation background. It is really one of the key, truly, if we could identify what they look like, it would be a whole lot easier for us to preempt. But since it is really the behavior of disarming the alarms around children that gets them access, they can look like anyone.
First Assistant District Attorney Lillian Salsinas-Bright, you've prosecuted a lot of these cases. And when you think about the range of of people that you've charged and then convicted of these kinds of crimes, what do they look like? Who are they?
You know, I think Amy is absolutely right. If we had that answer, we would know who to keep everyone safe from. There are typically more men prosecuted than women. That does not rule out women as offenders by any means. They are, as Amy has said, from every spectrum, every walk of life, every type of profession, and so on. They tend to be, for the most part, people who were entrusted with children or who have gained the trust of people in their communities that allows them to be in the company of children.
Michelle Zappel, you've had Carolina Gymnastics Academy for many years, and this is a business that serves primarily children in the community. And so you've had your encounters with people that you've wondered about, but tell us how you protect children in your care. What are some of the basic rules?
Well, in terms of what most people think of when they're thinking about gymnastics, they think about the coaches. And so we do background checks, and those are, they're better than they used to be, but they're not foolproof. A background check is only going to alert me to somebody who has already come in contact with law enforcement and either been arrested or convicted. And most people, that's not most people who are applying for a job. So I really haven't had any coaches that I have had to be concerned about. My concern is just regular everyday people. And like Amy was saying, most people don't think they would ever know or that they would ever be in contact with a sexual predator. And when parents think about sexual abuse, they imagine the person that they see in mugshots, mm-hmm. and the guy does look like what you described. But what they can't remember is the day before, they just, if you took a picture of that person the day before, they looked like everybody else. They were the popular teacher. They were the coach that everybody loved. They were the youth pastor. They were somebody's dad or somebody's stepdad, and they just looked like every other person.
Why is it the popular teacher or the popular coach or the pastor, Amy Feith? I mean, why don't kids get the hackles going up on the back of their neck around these people?
I think that a child predator oftentimes is their the gift that they have is that gift of being able to disarm the alarms that are not in the child victim first and primary, because for children, especially in our society, the alarm you have to disarm first is community, adults around the immediate child, and then the child. And so once we've gotten through community into a school setting or into a athletic setting or into a church setting, now you've got the community's buy-in, then the reverence that the adults around the child pay to whoever that adult is and however they see that adult is also going to disarm the alarms even further. So if the protections from the adults around that child are that they are not concerned about or trust that child or trust that adult, then the children are going to follow suit with what their adults do. And so oftentimes those funny tummy feelings that we talk about don't happen until well into the process.
And I do want to talk more about those funny tummy feelings, because that's part of the education for kids about this. But Lillian Salcinas-Bright, this new law that goes into effect December 1st, you've said that there is no statute of limitations on felonies,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
So how does this open up a window? Aren't most child sex abuse crimes felonies?
They are. And so, again, the new law that we're addressing right now appears to impact the ability for people to sue civilly. And it just, again, provides another avenue. The reality is that, yes, most of the crimes that fall in the category of abuse of children are felonies.
Okay. Another thing that I thought was interesting about this law is that it says it strengthens penalties for adults who fail to report somebody who should reasonably know about this crime. Isn't that already a mandate?
It is a mandate, and typically people are trained about it in their work settings. And so it really impacts professionals who attend classes and seminars and have HR departments and are instructed about mandated reporting. But the average person doesn't necessarily feel that they fall under that category of people who are mandated to report.
So how do you prosecute something like that? I mean, it seems tough already, but this law claims to increase those penalties for not reporting. What does that mean?
Well, I think what we're hearing right now is a reaction to the very real part of this problem, which is that if nobody feels a sense of an obligation or responsibility to report, then things don't get reported. It's bringing an awareness that people might fear a penalty if they fail to act and report. So hopefully what the new law is saying is that we're going to address this, we're taking it seriously, it's going to be documented, we're going to pursue it. The real question is, in terms of enforcement, we're right back to square one, which is finding out that someone failed to report, which doesn't typically occur until the damage has occurred to the child. So it's helpful to have that in place, and it's a good conversation for people to have and to take seriously. We won't know the complexities of proving a case of mandated failing to report unless it is typically in a professional setting where things are documented or left undocumented.
Such as in New Hanover County Public Schools, where teacher Michael Kelly worked for decades and there were parent complaints about him. And I'm sorry, if you want to say something about that when we come back from this break, I'll give you a chance. You're listening to Coastline. We're learning how pedophiles operate within a community, why they're hard to spot, why their crimes are hard to prosecute. Assistant District Attorney Lillian Salcinas-Bright, the Carousel Center's Amy Feith, and Carolina Gymnastics Academy's Michelle Zappel are with us today. We'll be back after this short break. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Child sex abuse is so abhorrent that it's not exactly a topic people are eager to lean into. But given its prevalence in the culture, both on a global level expressed in the very public cases of Jeffrey Epstein, U.S. Olympics gymnast team coach Larry Nassar, and locally, New Hanover County Public School teacher Michael Kelly, Nicholas LaVon Oates, it's clear that more people and communities need to learn the signs and better ways of protecting kids. Michelle Zappel is co-owner of Carolina Gymnastics Academy, also an underwriter of WHQR. Amy Feith is executive director of the Carousel Center. And Lillian Salcinas-Bright is first assistant district attorney in New Hanover and Pender counties. Just before we went to break, Lillian Salcinas-Bright, you were explaining what this new state law that was signed by the governor earlier this month might mean for people who fail to report cases of child sex abuse that they should reasonably have known about. And you were saying that this is really applicable to people in professional settings, for instance, in public school systems.
That's right. I mean, the law applies to every person over the age of 18 who has reason to believe that there's a child that's being victimized and that they are provided with the opportunity to anonymously report to some degree by reporting it to the Department of Social Services and so on. The reality is, in terms of cases that reach a prosecutor's desk, it comes mostly in the form of people who work in a setting where things are documented on a regular basis, because then you have the opportunity to determine whether things were left undocumented. The harder position is whether it's the average person in the average community who fails to make a phone call. At what stage did they fail to meet the requirement of the law, or at what stage were they still processing it to determine whether they were in a position to make that call?
I can think of so many scenarios that aren't professional situations that would involve the average person. But during the break, Michelle Zappel, you asked, I think, a really important question.
Yes, I was asking, where does that put the mothers in the situation? And a lot of women are in the situation where they might have a suspicion or they might have seen something, and it puts them in a really bad position to be that mandated reporter within their own family.
And so if I could address that.
Please.
The reality is, the message that needs to be very clear, I hope, from this segment and this conversation is that every adult has a responsibility, and parents have an even higher degree of legal responsibility for protecting and keeping their children safe. And so there is no legal pass or excuse that allows a parent to simply allow something to continue when they know that it comes at a cost to their children, especially the high cost that comes from victimization sexually and physically. You don't want to place adult family members in positions of danger. So the real question is, what do we provide as the appropriate avenues for them to be able to report, for them to be able to have the support that they need to deal with the repercussions of making that report? There would not be a more frightening scenario as a parent than to believe that the person that you may have as an intimate partner or a family member that you care about and love could be sexually victimizing your child. And so what we would do is encourage you, if you have any reason to believe that that is happening, then pick up the phone, report it to the appropriate authorities, distance yourself long enough to have that investigated, and then determined by other professionals about where this is going and why.
Amy Feith with the Carousel Center, you also play a role on mm-hmm. a Title IX committee for New Hanover County Public Schools.
Correct.
And this committee was formed in response to a number of different cases involving mm-hmm. different people, but Michael Kelly is probably the highest profile, and this is a person who was a teacher in the school system for more than a couple of decades mm-hmm. who routinely engaged in sexually abusive behavior with kids.
Yes. And for me, I feel like one of the jobs we have as a community when we're talking about, again, the high profile pieces is what you really hear about. But at the Carousel Center, this is a daily routine occurrence. And I would just caution those listening that when you focus on the ones that we are talking about, there are lots that I'm not as worried about the ones that we have already identified as a community and held accountable as a community.
But he's such a good example, though, because he existed in this community for so many bloody years, and he was a popular teacher.
But what
and there were parental complaints, too.
Correct.
So what happened there?
So oftentimes what I have seen over the course of my career doing this work for 30 years is that we get, as a community, a little bit less concerned about the actual individual survivor of an issue, because there is a larger entity that we're worried about their reputation, or we're worried about how that appears, or how is our university looked at? How is our church looked at? And I think that those are very natural protections. But I think the mandated reporting law that we have in North Carolina is a perfect example of how, if you follow it, you can really, in essence, be doing your due diligence. I always say to our team, I'd rather report it and be wrong a million times than to not report it. It is not my job, even at the Carousel Center, and we're a child advocacy center, we're not the experts in determining, does it meet the threshold of child abuse according to statute? We have an entity whose job it is. There is a criminal piece and there's a child protective piece. Both of them have investigators that are to determine the elements that create that rise to that level of criteria. And so I think in cases like Mr. Kelly's case, I feel like where we fail is we're looking at a broader sense of trying to protect an entity rather than a very simple following of what is already a part of our community fabric that we're afraid to follow for many reasons, going back to the Kitty Genovese situation of, I don't want to be involved. I don't want to get involved.
Are you saying that the failure happened because there were people trying to protect the public school system?
I think there's always, I think in my experience with victims, there is always that in sexual abuse cases, especially child sexual abuse cases, we as adults in our community don't want to believe it happens. Mm-hmm. So we are looking for every way that we can distance ourselves from it. It can't possibly be true. And it certainly shouldn't or can't be true of someone that is a beloved person in the community or a beloved person that has access to children or does wonderful things for children. But I have said often, you can be a brilliant chemistry teacher and also a predator of children. You can be a brilliant filmmaker and also have violated a child statutory rape law. You can be brilliant at one piece and also be the other. And I think that that's the complexity that we deal with, even just in intimate families, that makes it even harder for that victim to be able to heal because they have complex feelings of love and not liking this incident.
You know, you mentioned that you'd rather be wrong 100 times and report and let the proper entities figure out whether criminal behavior has occurred. Michelle Zappel, it's not easy. I mean, you are the owner of a business and you deal with kids all day long. And so you see all kinds of people and all kinds of situations. What's at risk for you when you report?
Well, to make a report, say to DSS, it's not done frivolously. Parents shouldn't be afraid that, you know, people are just willy-nilly calling them and making a report.
And to be clear, this is anonymous, so supposedly yes, there's no risk, but there is a risk.
Yes. But if I'm making a report, I'm usually not anonymous. I don't worry about that. I consider the impact on the child and the family. I consider that DSS and law enforcement and the court system all have different levels of proof and that they're constrained by those standards. And I also consider if a parent suspects me as being the one to report, they do retaliate, and they retaliate with physical threats, with verbal.
You've been physically threatened?
Yes, with verbal intimidation and with threats to your reputation. And so all those things go into it. I do report, but this is where USA Gymnastics got into the problem that they got into, because not just USA Gymnastics, but all sports and all entities like Amy was talking about, there were a lot of people who would, to save their reputation of their gym, they would fire the coach and just let them go on to the next. And if somebody called for a reference, they would not tell. They would just let it go and become somebody else's problem.
So then you're indirectly continuing to perpetrate child sex abuse.
Yes. Unless you're willing to say and risk the blowback from the person, that's how it just happens. And people don't want to get involved. They just want the problem to go away. And they feel like that if there was sexual abuse in their gym by a coach, they think that would reflect badly on them and their gym, instead of like putting it out there, handling it right out in public, which is the better way. The parents
it
would
is
say
a
like,
better
oh my
way.
Gosh, they but just that, took care of it right away.
But that fear that you're talking about, though, is still understandable and real.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And is that more prevalent than, is that more of a motivator in terms of how people decide what they do than the better way, which is actually reporting?
I think it was with USA Gymnastics until the Larry Nassar trial. I think now, you know, I'm the chairperson for North Carolina for Rhythmic Gymnastics, and so I've been to the headquarters of USA Gymnastics to speak to them. A lot of it was just, I felt it was legal protection for USA Gymnastics when I went there to hear what they had to say. But what I did take away from it is that nobody should be hiding anybody, and that we all should agree to tell. And like here in Wilmington, if we have a coach that does, and I'm not talking about sexual abuse, but just a bad coach that we don't like their behavior, we, all the gym coaches, all the gym owners, we call each other and we say, like, I had this problem with this guy or this girl or this woman, do not hire. And I mean, and that.
So you have your own little network.
We have
informal
our own network here
where
in Wilmington.
You'll say red flag with
yes,
this person.
Definitely. Definitely.
Lillian Salcinas Bright, how do you determine, because part of the risk that Michelle Zappel's talking about is, what if I report
and I'm not reporting anonymously, and I get these threats, or I make it worse for the child somehow, or I make the home situation unsafe. As a prosecutor, when do you know that you have enough to charge the person?
Well, and in answering that, I wanted to say that the correlation to the comments that have just been made by Amy and Michelle is that the same process comes into play with families about how the family entity will be affected when the report is made or family members are confronted with the allegations. Specifically for children, it's very difficult knowing that if they raise the flag, it may mean that they get removed from the family that they want to be a part of, or that the people they love the most will be removed and everyone else will be very upset about that.
Which is part of what keeps a child quiet.
Yes. Right? And so part of the process, like what Michelle is describing and Amy is talking about, when you charge a person criminally with an offense, particularly a sexual offense, you have to be very aware that you can obviously ruin reputations. You can cause harm and ripple effects, if you will, that aren't apparent at the very beginning. So you can't take that responsibility lightly. For me, the standard has always been, what is it that the child has said? What are the details that can be investigated and leads that can be pursued? What can we bring forward in that investigation to corroborate what the child is reporting? And what evidence do we have so that the entire case doesn't rise and fall with the child's testimony?
How difficult is that? How often do you have physical evidence?
We don't always have physical evidence. And let me begin by commending the investigators, because we're the lawyer piece. We get the work product, we have conversation, we're consulted at different stages, we ask for a lot, and the investigators do as much as possible to obtain the evidence that we hope might be there and might exist. Physical evidence, not always DNA, unfortunately, not always physical signs of injury. Those are the easier cases, and certainly for juries and fact finders, it's so important for them to have that. What we do find is that many times it's all in the details of what the child can relate, because so much of it can be corroborated. It can be as simple as confirming what the child described was in the place where the event happened. It can be wallpaper. It can be books on a shelf. It can be the color of a bedspread. It also comes in the form of children's ability in their way to explain timelines. Where were you living? Who was a part of your household? Was it a time when you had just moved? Was it before a significant birthday for you, or Christmas, or another holiday that's celebrated in your family or community? Children do an exceptional job of providing us with information, and it's up to us as the adults hearing it to work with them and to listen to what it is they're giving us. The leads, the clues come from that.
Amy Feith of the Carousel Center, when we think about listening to children, what are some of the things that they sometimes will say to us that could be clues that a lot of people wouldn't hear if they weren't educated and primed?
Yeah, I really appreciate what Lillian is sharing, because it's our experience on a daily basis that, especially with child sexual abuse, frequently that is not disclosed like you would envision an adult sexual violence experience. It's a chronic experience that is a delayed disclosure, so there isn't frequently going to be physical evidence, which on one hand can be immensely a relief to the adult caregiver and to the child that their physical body is safe and healthy. For the other side of that, for the investigators and CPS or Child Protective Services, and for especially our criminal investigators, that can be one piece that they don't have. And so I really appreciate what Lillian said, is that we really as a community have to be willing to look deeper than just what the child is able to go on the record saying, and whether there's physical evidence, because oftentimes that's going to be in a jury situation, a tenuous house of cards to put all your faith into. At Carousel, we hear frequently children who are exhibiting behaviors that are they're completely opposite of what they might have been. So it's a 180-degree change, and their adult caregivers can almost actually pinpoint a point in time, maybe not an action or exactly what was the cause of it, but there was an essence of a point in time when their disposition changed. And made 180 degree. They were very introverted, and now they're extremely extroverted and maybe very precocious. And
really, so it could be the opposite, because I often think of that change as being a child who becomes withdrawn and depressed. But you're saying it could be that. Yeah. It could be the antithesis of that.
Yes, yes. And so that opposite behavior generally for a caregiver is alarming, because they're wondering, what's the motivator there? Gut instinct of that mama bear, papa bear should be adhered to, because that is a very good indicator. The other thing that I think that really is a good indicator is, a lot of times our community feels that when we label children as bad behaviored children, that is a result of a willful ability or willful choice of the child to defy community standards. I often say, why? What's happening to you?
This also happened in New Hanover County Public Schools. There was a young girl who said she was assaulted by a fellow student, and this was dismissed for a while because teachers and administrators said that girl is kind of a problem. She's a pot stirrer. She's trouble.
So two things that always happen in my head when I hear stories like that is, I always say, what's happened to that child other places, or in totality of context of their neighborhood, their household, what other pieces are we missing that this behavior you're talking about could be a manifestation of earlier trauma that has gone unresolved? And then the second piece of that is, most victims who are victimized early tend to have a higher risk to be victimized again. So I'm always worried that we are still talking about somebody that needs intervention and support.
You're listening to Coastline. Why do we hear stories about child sexual abuse perpetrated for years and going undetected? We're exploring that question today and how communities can do a better job of protecting their kids. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Perpetrators of child sexual abuse are often people with no criminal background. In fact, they can be trusted members of the community. And it's a well-groomed community that allows such a person to continue to commit their crimes. Today, we're learning more about the dynamics of this with Amy Feith, Executive Director and Victim Services Provider for the Carousel Center, Lillian Salcinas-Bright, First Assistant District Attorney for New Hanover and Pender Counties, and Michelle Zappel, co-owner of Carolina Gymnastics Academy in Wilmington. They are an underwriter of WHQR. Michelle Zappel, in your experience, what kind of kids are most likely to become victims of predators?
Well, any child can be at risk, but in my experience, and not just at my gym, but with the public case with Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics, I do know some of those national team members on a personal basis, and they are all good kids. They are considered the ones that never give you any trouble. They don't talk back. They just do what you say. And those kids are especially at risk. They want to be good. They want to be quiet. They keep a secret.
They're high achievers,
which means
making the adults around them happy.
Yes. And there's nothing about the child that would, to the public, you would say, oh my gosh, that child has just finished being abused. I mean, there is video of these girls performing on the world stage at the Olympics, and literally hours before, they were being abused by Larry Nassar. And so when you're seeing a child in your facility, whether it's the school or the gym, they can look completely fine, and something horrific has been happening at their house in the hours before you see them. They look fine, because to you, they are going to present that public face.
Lily and Salsina Sprite, I know all three of you have kind of ideas about what makes a child more vulnerable. And so Michelle says it's that high-achieving, compliant child who wants to make people happy around them, who wants to be quiet, who wants to be seen as a star. Who are the kids who are most vulnerable in your experience, Lillian?
Well, I guess the overall theme for me when I talk about that is the lack of supervision, the instability in terms of the people who are left in, that the child is left in their care, the different people who are not well-known to the family, but not strangers to the family, that come into that child's orbit, if you will. It's all about supervision, and it's not uncommon to find that many of the children that we meet through our cases, that their parent or multiple family members have been victimized as well. And so what you're talking about is a process where people don't report. Children are exposed to people who have been traumatized or are in unstable household settings, and that the child is very vulnerable because at all times of the day or night, there are different people coming in and out of their households. That unfortunately leads to a lot of victimization. The other component of this, which we haven't really addressed yet, is that when you have children who are the offenders or perpetrators of sexual abuse, not always, but mostly it is offenses perpetrated on children younger than themselves, that they're victimized or close in age to them. And unfortunately, the confusion that comes for children at that in that particular setting is that there's a big confusion about whether they're experiencing something that's pleasurable and okay, or they're being victimized by someone who looks like another kid that they're playing with.
And being pleasurable and being victimized, those two things can exist in the same reality.
They can. They absolutely can. And then you have a population of children who have become sexually active, if you will, and there are no age-appropriate sex partners for them. That isn't something that's accepted socially, and it's not something culturally that's public in any way. And so then those children have to live with the stigma that something has happened to them, that they didn't know it was wrong for a long time, and now it's something that maybe they would consider doing consensually, but that's not acceptable. I mean, talk about a taboo or a forbidden subject or something that people are uncomfortable with. It's a conversation that a lot of those children don't have the privilege of conducting with professionals who can work them through that process.
Amy Feith, we have a culture where sexually graphic images are readily available. Mm-hmm. At what age do you think most kids have seen porn?
Well, I mean, we always say, too, and, you know, our therapists at Carousel are really clear about years ago, even 10 years ago. No, it's not that long ago. If a child was acting out sexually that was not necessarily within their same age range, you know, age-appropriate sexual acting out or exploration, we would say, oh my gosh, what's happening to that child? Something's definitely happening. Now, with the technology the way that it is much more common that you have to go as a community way deeper than that. And you have to have a process in your community that allows for you to look at context, because kids are getting access through technology to images that you can't even imagine.
And this is not just the rogue kid who grabs mom's smartphone and then goes to a website. This is it fair to say this is most kids have seen sexually graphic images at a much younger age than previous generations?
I would say that that's probably true.
I mean, that's changing now.
It is changing. And also, don't forget that in technology, it's all what you name it. So a child that's picking up a piece of technology and maybe going to, you know, Barney's Playhouse or whatever, there is no telling what kind of images you're going to see with that kind of, that's not even a real site, by the way. I just want to go on.
Thank you for that. I'm just thinking
site.
Now all these people are
all
going
people
to that.
I just thought of that too. But no, that's
okay.
It's not a real site. But I'm just saying, like, that it can be a completely innocent act of utilizing technology the way it was designed to broaden our horizons, and it will take them down a rabbit hole that, of course, they're going to be looking at and saying, what is this? And then the other thing that we see frequently is the older children who do have access to that because of whatever age they are showing the younger children those things. Or, of course, adults that are perpetrators are going to be acting in that same way.
Which is what Michael Kelly did, what he pled guilty to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have talked a little bit about how the criminal justice system works in these cases, but Lillian Salcinas-Bright, you say it's just not really built for children. And one of the elements, the U.S. Constitution says that someone who's accused of a crime has the right to face their accuser in the same room.
That's right. So we ask the same of child witnesses as we do of adult witnesses in terms of their taking a witness stand, taking some oath, affirmation to tell the truth, responding to multiple questions by multiple lawyers. I think everyone can relate to how confusing it is to have any attorney, myself included, ask a question that sounded relatively simple when I started phrasing it, but ends up being very complicated. And we're asking children to respond in a courtroom setting with the offender seated in that same space. There is, to a limited degree, the ability to apply for what I'll call an exception to that, where a judge can make certain rulings and findings that it would be appropriate for the child to be allowed to testify outside of the actual room where the offender is.
Why would the child's childness not be an appropriate reason for the child to testify in a separate room? I mean,
that's a great question. And it would be a dream come true, I think, for children and advocates of children to have there be an exception that says any child under the age of, define the age, 10, 8, 6, be given the option of testifying in a more child-friendly environment. The dangers to due process obviously are that you need to be certain that the child understands the seriousness of what they're saying and that there's an opportunity for the defense and for the state and for the fact finders to hear those answers and to understand that we haven't made it so simple that the child is literally not engaged in the process and thinks that it's something not as serious as the criminal process.
You bring up due process. We always hear when it comes to sexual abuse, but particularly child sexual abuse, Amy Feith, that kids don't make this stuff up. But do they? I mean, sometimes... Are adults wrong? Sometimes are kids telling stories to get attention?
So I think that the straight statistics show that there is no higher level of false reporting in child sexual abuse than any other, you know, sexual violence crime. It ranges about 2% or less from the FBI statistics. What I will say that often happens is that... that a child has a different level of what they're able to understand and how they're able to communicate, because oftentimes if you have a child that's young, their general nature of communication is through play or through activity, not through verbal communication. And so I think what happens, just as Lillian has pointed out, is that you've got adult jurors with adult mindsets expecting language and a chain of communication that is adult-like, not from the five-year-old's mindset. What I have experienced, even over a 30-year career, is that children will describe what has occurred in the most child-like ways. Mm-hmm. They will use words that they have no clue when they are talking about a sexual act that adults that hear them describing what's happening are very clear what that means.
Can you give us an example of that?
I mean, I can give you an example of that. I'm not sure. Do you feel that it is appropriate to give an example of that? Like I've had children that have said, and of course, I guess you can leap it out if you need to, but I mean, they have said, I was coloring with a child. She's five. And she splurted out, you know, when I pull on my dad's wink, white blood comes out. Now, to adults that hear that, they know exactly what that means.
Right.
She had no idea what that meant. And she
How old did you say she was?
She was five. And so she had no idea what was the context of that. But what she did know is that all the adults around her went crazy when that was stated, when it was disclosed to them. And then daddy was gone. And so, like Lillian talked about, that is often why children will recant, or when they, or they will say something and see what happens from the adults around them, and then they'll just shut up and not want to restate any of that because they're worried about that response.
So their world has been shattered, correct, as they knew it.
It's not that it's not true.
Right.
It's that a child is not thinking in those terms. A child is thinking that if my adult caregiver, the non-offending one, is distressed and upset and their world is falling apart because of something I said, I did that to her.
Right. Michelle Zappel, certainly there, over the course of the years, there must have been times that you've reported what you thought were situations involving child sexual abuse and then nothing came of it. What do you think now? Do you think that you were ever wrong? Do you think that there are children out there that are just kind of lost to the wind, to the abusive situation?
When I have reported, I am reasonably sure that it is happening. And
I mean, do you hear things as graphic as what Amy just said?
I do, yes. And when I report, I'm disappointed when the letter comes back that says nothing was found.
How often does that happen? Is it like a 50-50 situation, or
I would
90-10,
say,
or?
I would say 70-30.
70,
nothing was found to substantiate it, is usually what it says. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. Doesn't mean it's not still happening. It means that they couldn't substantiate it. And to go back to what Julie was talking about, a lot of people have this feeling that if they do report or something goes to court with any kind of sexual abuse, they feel like the burden of proof is so much higher for that than for other crimes. You could say, this guy stole my car, and everybody's right on it. Nobody says, like, are you making this up? Are you lying that, you know, I mean, we don't think like that. And we always say that person's a victim. When somebody accuses somebody of sexual abuse, they are called the accuser. And right away, you're the accuser. That's not the same as somebody who is reporting another type of crime.
Lillian Salcinas-Bright, is that a fair comparison? I mean, you've talked about the gravity of this when there is an adult who has allegations against them of child sexual abuse. That's something that, if proven, and sometimes not, if not proven, it still can ruin their reputation, their livelihood, their family life.
What I would say, and to sort of summarize a little bit about what Michelle just expressed, is you can accuse a person of pretty much any crime you can think of, and people will react to it, maybe accepting it, maybe not. But once you try to voice that someone may have a sexual deviancy, there is not a friend or family member or coworker who hears that and wants to immediately say, okay, I hear it and I'm believing that. It's
right.
Very difficult to imagine that someone is sexually victimizing other people and that you have any association or knowledge of them as a person.
Now, we just have a minute left. So adults, one of the things that adults need to teach their kids is never to keep secrets. Like adults, there's something wrong if an adult ever asks a child to keep a secret. Mm-hmm. What else? What should people be thinking about for the holiday season? Happy Thanksgiving, by the way.
That children own their bodies and that they shouldn't be forced to hug or kiss.
Even if it's grandma.
Even if it's grandma, if it's still teaching that child that you have the right, if you don't feel like it, that you can say no to a hug or a kiss.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Amy Feith, Michelle Zappel, Lillian Salcinas-Bright, thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Coastline's producer is Caitlin Freund. Technical director is Ken Campbell. News producer is Rachel Keith. Marissa Castrino is today's engineer. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast or find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoons. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.